Aloha, I am Amanda Wacker.
Hola, I am Lenise Castro.
Swadika, I'm Masama Lekbua.
Hola, and I am Omar Lujano.
And we are the Triplicates. We are on the 10th episode. Welcome to many episodes. I don't know why this is always the sentence I mess up on. I think
it's okay.
Rewrite this one. It's fine. Anyways. And we are the Triplicates. Welcome to the 10th of many episodes of the Triplicate Podcast. We are three first-generation women of color currently in our first year of our PhD program at the University of California, San Diego.
So last episode, my peer mentor, Saroj, came on and talked to us a little about being co-mentored by two PIs, and that was super cool. We learned a lot. If you haven't listened to it, please check it out. And now, Asama.
We also heard from you that you were really enjoying guest appearances on our show, and we want to give you more of that. This week, we have another wonderful guest on our show.
Welcome to the show, Omar.
Welcome. Hello. Hi, friends. Good
seeing
you.
Hello, friends.
All.
Nice to see you.
Omar, outside of class, too.
Yes. Still on Zoom.
Still on Zoom.
Outside of class, though.
Only interface.
Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit? We know you, but the audience would love to know you.
Alrighty. So my name is Omar, and I am a second year PhD student, and I joined doctoral program with UCSD and SDSU. I currently do research in the house lab where we look at cancer. Specifically, we look at resistance to therapy. And more importantly, and what interests me the most, is the tumor microenvironment. Is that good enough?
If you want, I think we'll go through it when we talk about why you're here today. And you're here today to tell us a little bit about your experience being a DACA student and, you know, navigating undergrad and going into a PhD program. So why don't we start in the beginning? So I guess like high school moving into undergrad, like what was that situation like?
Right. Yeah. So I am a DACA recipient. And so essentially what that means is DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Meaning that I was once a child that came to the United States very young. My parents brought me here. I'm undocumented. And during my senior year in high school, the Obama administration used executive action or order to start this program, which essentially allows kids in my situation where we're undocumented, but we've literally lived mostly our whole lives in this country, essentially giving us some legal status. So if it wasn't for this program, my life would have been completely different. First and foremost, going to college would have been very difficult. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, the state of California does have some legislation that allows for undocumented students to receive some help. If it wasn't for, I believe it's called the AB 540, mm-hmm. if it wasn't for that, I would not be able to receive, I guess I wouldn't be able to do tuition in-state. I would be considered a out-of-state person since I don't have a legal status. But with the implementation of DACA, it allowed me to essentially have some legal status that allowed for me to have a work authorization card. So with this, it allowed me to essentially get, become an employee somewhere where I have actual legal status to have a actual job that doesn't require me to be under the table, like a lot of undocumented people in this country have to go through. So that happened in high school. I just honestly got really lucky. Like 2013, I would say, or 2012 is when the action was achieved and allowed for me, like one of the first essentially generations to apply for the program. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of a guinea pig in the situation. So essentially the application process was very interesting. They require everything. So they required every single aspect of since I got here. So going even from my birth certificate from Mexico, ID cards all the way from elementary school, middle school, high school, essentially anything that I can use to prove that I've been in this country, you know, for whatever duration of time I said I am, mm-hmm. Which is pretty much in the age of 6 or 7. So this country is all I know. So thankfully I received the DACA status, and with that in a combination with this AB 540 bill, that allowed me to essentially be almost a normal student like everyone else, with the only exception being that I can receive federal funding. Mm-hmm. So meaning that I can get federal loans. So that's the only little asterisk, I guess, is that in terms of practicality, when it comes to getting loans, I would have to get private loans. Thankfully, as an undergrad at UC Santa Barbara, there was a lot of aid through the university system, through the UC mm-hmm. system. And so I never really had to struggle too much. And also with DACA giving me employment authorization, I could also do work study. So in a combination of being at the right time, at the right place, in the right state, it allowed me to essentially be almost a, you know, normal college student without having to worry too much financially and about my status. So, and I know there's people out there who also have gone through similar experiences as me, because I know a few, especially as an undergrad at UC Santa Barbara. I remember, yeah, talking to a couple, and yeah, so that's pretty much how it all began. It began with getting this DACA, being a DACA recipient, and starting, you know, college like any other American kid. Also being an immigrant and coming from Mexico, so just south of the border. I'm from I was born in Guadalajara, Jalisco. So it's Jalisco is a state, you know, where we have tequila and mariachi music all of the traditional, all the traditional, you know, stereotypical things that, you know, represent, you know, Mexico. So that was my upbringing from Mexico. It's I don't remember much from it other than my grandparents owned a dairy farm. And so I do have a lot of memories of me just milking cows and, you know, like,
oh my gosh,
things like that.
I love this.
I have a question about the cows. I heard something. I'm so sorry.
They're very smart.
I heard that cows dance when they're happy. Like, is that true?
They love music, and they also respond to whistles. And they're smart. I swear, I remember my uncle, like, all the cows had a name. So, you know, my uncle would call the next cow to get milk, and it would be like, no offense if this is your name, but it's like, Camila, like, come here. And the cow would just come. So they're as smart as almost a dog, I would say, like equivalent mm-hmm. intelligence. And yeah, they are very smart animals, and they're wonderful. And yeah, we were a dairy farm, so we were not a slaughterhouse, by the way, dairy farm. So we took care of our cows, grass fed. They were happy, living a great life, from what I remember as a 6-year-old.
So funny. I don't know if Amanda remembers that, or was it a song? I don't know. I told someone. Funny that you mentioned, I didn't know you were from Guadalajara, Jalisco, because when I go to Mexico, I stop by there, and then my family's from Michoacan, so I visited there. Oh, okay. But I also have a story about cows.
Please share.
Your uncle or family probably would have hated me because at my little rancho, I would feed the cows mangoes, and the milk would be soured. But it was so fun, like having the cow just take the whole mango.
It's funny.
Yeah.
That's how you make flavored milk.
I guess so. I just know I got reprimanded by my uncle.
Yeah, my family is also huge. Besides, you know, milk, they would also make cheeses. So nice. A lot of like fresh Mexican cheese, yogurt as well. Yeah, so anything dairy related they would do. That was my upbringing. Was up till around 6 or 7, I was living a good life in Mexico, and my dad came to the States mm-hmm. In search of you know, opportunity to make more money in order to send back to my mom. Because at the time, my parents wanted to build a second story to the current home that we were living in Mexico. Mm. And so, yeah, they wanted to, you know, America, of course, was at the time and still is, you know, the place you go if you're searching for work and want to make money. And so that's what happened. And my dad was in the States working. Well, my mom was back in Mexico with me and my sister. And after a year, I think my dad just, he's a social butterfly. So I think...
no wonder where you got that from.
Yeah, I know. I actually went home on Sunday and I was talking to my dad. And I swear, now that I'm at this age group of, I'm 25 now. And every time I go home, I study my parents. I observe them. And I'm like, wow, so that's where I got that from. Oh, so that's where I got, you know? And you're like, wow, I can just understand myself through my parents. But yeah, so yeah, my dad's a social butterfly. And I guess I picked up on a couple of those things as well. But he essentially made really good connections. And even though he was undocumented, he was able to make good connections with people that always had work. And he never really struggled. There was definitely a struggle, but compared to other immigrant stories, I think I was very fortunate because, yeah, my dad was able to make good connections and was able to solidify himself in Southern California. And after a while, my dad was like, honestly, you know, Mexico is great and all, but I think that Omar and, you know, my sister would, you know, would have a bit more opportunities educationally here in the U.S. And so that's what it was about. My dad and my mom realized that, yeah, they would have better opportunity here in the U.S. Me and my sister got in a car. We went across. No one inspected us. And that was it. Came here. And since then, yeah, just lived my life here. Once I got to UC Santa Barbara and I was a college student, just like everyone else, being again coming from an immigrant family and being an immigrant myself, there's always that dream, right? That American dream of, you know, your parents bring you here and you are now destined to be the doctor in the family.
Yes.
Yes. This is true.
So it's like cool, you know, like we brought you here, you know, and I've now take the baton and go to school. Yeah. Now so same vibe. I feel like you guys probably got a little bit of that as well. So yeah, it was that. It was, I came here and knowing my parents were like, we're here because we want you to get an education. Don't waste it. Mm-hmm. Like, make the best of it. You know, like, we wish we were in your position. It's like, okay, yeah. So no pressure whatsoever. I get it. Cool.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, going into UC Santa Barbara after being a DACA recipient, not having to worry so much financially on how to cover tuition and all those costs, I was able to live and experience a college life like anyone else, with, of course, that influence of my parents obviously wanting me to be a doctor, a lawyer, or some of those big roles, you know?
Yeah.
Entrepreneur.
Exactly.
That's it.
That's all there is.
Whatever makes a lot of money. Like, that essentially seemed to be the goal, you know? And I get it. It's understandable. And so, yeah, my freshman year, I went to UC Santa Barbara and, you know, I really took it into consideration becoming a doctor, a medical doctor, of course, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I went the pre-med route for a little bit. And realized that besides how intense medical school is and the training, I also realized after shadowing doctors that I love the idea of helping people, especially with illnesses, but I personally do not enjoy interacting with patients. So once I realized that... It's just, I love talking to people and all that stuff, but when it comes to, you know, someone being sick and me having to help them, I just feel like I would feel it too much and I would just be depressed all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And besides that, also, again, being undocumented was an extra hurdle where being undocumented and trying to go to medical school was going to be really, really tough in terms of financial need, because I won't qualify for federal loans. Therefore, I would have to take private loans. And as I think we all know here, you know, once you come out of medical school, you're at least, you know, $500K in debt. And that's with federal loans or so, right? I don't know the number, so don't quote me, but
yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's a lot of money, though.
A lot of money. It's a lot of money you're taking out. And as a U.S. citizen, you would be able to take out federal loans with a very manageable fixed rate, right?
Mm-hmm. Entrance rate.
That would not have been my case because, again, I don't qualify for federal aid. And therefore, I would have to go the private route, so private loans, where the interest rates are just ridiculous. So I would at least be like $1 million in debt if I went that route, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just knew it was not a practical career for me. I knew that, you know, even though I know it's really difficult and it's a passion of me to wanting to help people, I realized that being a medical doctor was not going to be the best route for me because of my current situation that I am mm-hmm. still. But
from there, what made you kind of decide you wanted to do a PhD? Or like what steered you towards this mm-hmm. different route of research?
Right.
Yeah. Of research,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it went from, cool, medical doctor, not going to work out based on my undocumented status and also just my own personal preferences of not really wanting to interact with sick patients who will probably be mad and angry and throw stuff at me. And so then I still find, you know, biomedical science is really, really interesting. And I really do want to help people. But instead of maybe going, you know, the patient route, I would just go ahead and take samples from patients and then figure it out in the lab. Right. So I started playing around with this idea. And I knew, well, the next thing I can do that's practical would probably be go into research, where I can just be a scientist, where I can be, you know, a research assistant, and maybe just go into the industry and work in some biomedical aspect of things, right? Mm-hmm. And so then my junior year, I applied for this work study / internship in the Biological Nanostructures Laboratory. At UC Santa Barbara. There's also a center at UCLA, actually. There was a sister center called the BNL over there as well. But anyway, so I got the job, I got the internship, started working there. And that's where I met my first mentor. And she was the lab manager of the Biological Nanostructures Corps. Mm-hmm. And she pretty much taught me all like basic things such as pipetting and cell culture and all of those very basic things you need in order to be a working tech, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then over time, I also started to actually do some research for her. So I was actually learning how to use some of the instruments around the lab. So I learned, you know, how to do like gel electrophoresis, things like that, how to quantify for nucleic acids, proteins, things like that. And then finally, she also taught me how to run and load NextSeq machines. So I was also doing a little bit of NGS. So that was fancy. Yeah. So it was cool. I remember I was like sequencing mitochondria DNA and I was like, mitochondria have DNA? Like what?
Yeah.
It was an whole thing. Yeah. Some mitochondrial DNA. And I was like, that's interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Awesome. And yeah, so I started doing that. And the thing about this core is that it's a, you know how we have the mass spec core and all these things where like every researcher can use the instruments and things like that. So it was the same setup. So it was me, I would do some of the sequencing and help out the lab manager do that, right? Based on other scientists that wanted to use the technique. And I would also do like general maintenance and some upkeep and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I would also always be in contact with a lot of researchers in other groups. So I met this postdoc, you know, just being a social butterfly like I am, I met this one postdoc named Vinu, who was working in this chemical engineering lab, working in drug delivery systems. And so I was like, that's really cool. And I loved organic chemistry and I love chemistry. So I was like, maybe this is something that I want to do. Like I'm up for just running some like 7, 10, 12 hour synthesis and, you know, just feeling like, you know, like, what's his name? Walter White? Is that his name?
Oh, no.
You know, like, that would be cool. Like, I want to be a cool chemist, you know, just like, but ultimately the drug delivery systems that they were doing were aided at different things like diabetes, cancer. But this postdoc in general was working with acute myeloid leukemia, AML. And what he was doing was he had this scaffold, and the scaffold is hyaluronic acid. So the stuff that's in all these hydrating creams that everyone
pays $500.
Yeah, I used to make this joke to my girlfriend at the time where I was like, it was like, you just paid $120 for that hyaluronic 1.2% cream. That I can make you a 10% hyaluronic cream in my lab. But yeah, so he was using this hyaluronic acid as a scaffold, and he was loading it with different anti-cancer drugs, essentially with the whole idea or theory that if you hit a cancer cell with multiple drugs at the same time, very precisely, you can have a synergistic effect. And so you can now use two drugs in the same cell to have two different mechanisms of action. Mm-hmm. Now, if there's resistance that develops through one pathway that you try to drug, the other pathway should complement that and still kill the cancer cell. Mm-hmm. And so that was the theory. And so, yeah, I was like, I would love to do that research with you. And so I started helping him, and he essentially, I already knew all the basics, pipetting and all that stuff, because mm-hmm. of my lab manager. So it was an easy transition where it's, okay, I know how to do that. And so, and also the nice thing was that his lab was upstairs from where I was working. So I can do my work as an intern, and then I can go upstairs and then do my work as a researcher while helping this postdoc. And I just really, I loved it, because after a while of doing it, you know, I started to have my own experience with it, and I started giving feedback to the postdoc where I was like, what if we tweak this instead? Or mm-hmm. what if we run this instead? What if we purify it this way instead? What if I collect both of these things and then we read that? And so it went on and on, and I really started liking it. But at the same time, I started realizing that, why are we doing this? We're doing this because all in all, the biology that we know of cancer is pretty good, but the targets that we're drugging obviously aren't working, and we can see that. And so we have to turn into these drug delivery systems. But even that is only so effective for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, like, man, if I really want to make a difference here, if I really want to, you know, stomp on this cancer thing, we really need to find better targets. We need to, like, better understand the biology of cancer. And so from that work, came to me graduating, I got a degree in pharmacology. And so I started thinking about it more. And I realized that what I really like to do right now is maybe take some time off and do more industry research, I guess, continue to build my technique. Mm-hmm.
Before we go there, follow-up question. So you yes. mentioned mm-hmm. that starting out, you got here, your parents are like, all right, firstborn, now you become a doctor. And then you're mm-hmm. like,
yeah,
that's for me. And then you start doing research, and you've been really good at it. At which point during maybe college or doing research did you have this conversation with your parents? Because I think we all can relate to some degree of, right. I'm going to be a doctor, but a different kind. What was yours like?
So yeah, interestingly, I mean, even till this day, I explain to them what I'm doing, and they're still like, wait, so you're a doctor? So you're trying to be a doctor? You know, so there's still a lot of that. But ultimately, I think I just was really, really lucky in the fact that my parents never really, like, pushed me so much. Like, they nudged at me, but it would never, they were, my mom and dad are just beautiful souls who never really pushed, you know, this on me. You know, they were like, okay, you don't want to do that? Cool. And then I would tell them, I want to do this instead. And they're like, okay, go for it. You know, we don't understand what you're doing, but go for it, you know? So they were always supportive. And I think that's really important as a parent, you know? It's, no matter where you come from and your cultural ties, I think first and foremost, like, a good parent is one that, you know, understands you know, even though they might not agree with it, they understand, you know? So that was my experience. It wasn't anything that hard. And the conversation was just like, you know what? I don't want to be a doctor, medical doctor. It's just not what I want to do. I don't want to work with patients. And they're like, okay. But I tell them, I still want to go into science and I am going to continue doing science because I love science. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to do it in this other aspect where I'm not working in the clinic. I'm going to be working in a research lab. Still trying to cure and trying to make the world better, you know, but different in a different context. So yeah, I just became very, I was just very lucky that my parents never were that pushy, you know, because I know there's a lot of immigrant parents out there who are like, you're not going to be a doctor. You're shunned from the family, you know, that was not my experience, luckily. But for those who are listening to that is their experience, I completely understand it, but you know, follow your dreams and do whatever you want to do. And hopefully at one point your parents will understand, you know, follow right. your passions. So, so that was my experience with my parents.
Cool. So you graduated, is it UCSB? Is that the acronym?
UCSB.
Good job. Mm-hmm.
You graduated with a degree in pharmacology and then you were like, I'm going to go work a little bit more in industry. How did that transition go?
So with all the experience that I had gotten with this research lab, and also with my internship, I had a solid basis to enter, entry level positions as a research assistant, lab assistant, whatever it is. The thing about Santa Barbara though, the biotech scene is very scarce. So there's probably no more than 4 biotech companies or so. There's probably more now.
We don't go there after.
Yeah, no.
So yeah, exactly. But there was 2 companies that were cancer diagnostic based. Agilent, which used to be Daco, and this smaller biotech company called BioSP. Both did cancer diagnostics, mostly focusing on using antibodies and antibody detection systems for pathology. So then I graduated. I started applying to jobs. Once I graduated, I also took some time off. Not a lot, but I got to explore. As a DACA recipient, I cannot leave the country. But I can travel anywhere in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Lucky for us, the U.S. includes Hawaii. So I went to Hawaii and I got a vacation there. This was in a past relationship. Parents lived there. So we got to stay at their house and I had a great time. And during that time, I was applying to jobs and I was in Maui and I was essentially like having interviews in Maui. So I was just like, yeah, it was a very relaxing time because it's supposed, you know, I'm trying to get my first job and, you know, it's like very stressful. But at the same time, I'm just like in Maui, you know, so I don't know how I feel about it. Yeah. But ultimately I came back from that trip refreshed, ready to go. I got a position at this BioSP company. So this smaller cancer diagnostics company, where I was a manufacturing specialist. So it was, it's a diagnostic company. We have, or they have very like strict protocols, right? Because all of these antibodies and detection systems are sent to hospitals all over the world, like France, Brazil, everywhere. And so, yeah, I got this entry position job doing immunohistochemistry manufacturing. From that experience, within a year, I started to, since it was small, I was able to go to different departments. So then with my research experience, they started to also give me some projects in R&D. So I started to also tinker around with creating these like detection systems for that are animal specific. So with antibodies, right, we usually have our rabbit monoclonals and polyclonals, and we have our mouse monoclonals, polyclonals, and goat, right? So I was creating like, say like a mouse specific detection system. And then I was doing like a rabbit specific detection system. And it was really cool. So that was my first project where I had freedom, you know, and tinkering around with the protocol as well. I mean, obviously being guided and reporting back to my lab manager and what I'm doing and things like that. But besides that, since we were doing antibody work and everything was for pathology, I was constantly working with tumor samples. And we had like so many different tissues because they were all embedded in paraffin. So you would just use a microtome and histology and would just cut up those tissues. And then you can stain for different antibodies. So you'll have those like markers, right, for malignant or non-malignant tumors, right? So you would have like E67, P53, null, things like that. And so I got to do a lot of staining for different proteins and then looking at it in the microscope with actual patient samples. And during that time, I also got to score slides and kind of be like a pathologist, but it was just because, you know, just because of quality control reasons, right? Like, obviously, like, I'm not a trained professional, so we had a whole department for that. But being a small company, I still was given the opportunity to essentially score slides and look at all of the pathology, and it was really cool. And during that whole time, I would always notice that besides cancer cells, there's all these other like cell types all over the tumor. Like I would see just like fibroblasts and macrophages and all these other different types of cells within the tumor. So I was just like really just interested. It's like we are always just focusing on the cancer cell. But man, it's like a whole village. You have fibroblasts, you have fat cells sometimes. So I just started to realize like, huh, maybe these cell types are also important, you know, like maybe they're helping cancer cells survive or something's going on there, because there was such a tight connection between cancer cells and like these spindle shaped fibroblasts, you know? So I was like, what's going on there? You know, what are these fibroblasts doing there? And so I went on the Googles and the Googles.
The Googles, yes.
So the Google said that there's this whole field called the tumor microenvironment, and how the stroma, how these non-cancerous cells actually aid tumors. And that just blew my mind. I was like, what?
Yeah.
There's a whole field on this. And that's when as soon as I read that, I was like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Like as soon as I saw that, I was like, this is what I'm doing. Cause I, you know, going from seeing it, you know, to then going online and looking at PubMed and realizing there's a whole field of this. It was just incredible. And so that's when I knew that's what I had to do. I was like, I need to figure out how these other cell types are helping the cancers grow, because this patient here is sadly not with us anymore because our therapies aren't good enough. Mm-hmm. And we're only targeting cancer cells without realizing that there's all these other signals being sent by all these other stromal cells that are also helping cancer grow or become resistant, or who knows what's going on. I mean, now we know what's going on for the most part, but there's always so much more to know.
Hearing your story, it seems like this like aha moment of being like,
yep,
this is what I want to do. Was it like right away your idea to like shift towards a PhD, or was there ever like a time you were like, kind of want to stay in the industry, or did you ever feel some type of way of like going back to school? Because that's a big step, sure. Right? Like me and Amanda, for example, came straight from undergrad. So we're like, taking classes is normal. Yeah, we're
just
babies.
Thank you. Sure.
But like, babies. I feel like once you end school, it's like, whoa, shifting back to taking classes and all that stuff is kind of like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Me AF.
Yeah, so definitely. So yeah, I had this aha moment. There was fireworks. There's actually fireworks happening right now outside of my house. Like,
what's
legit.
The occasion?
SeaWorld.
SeaWorld is that way.
It's so funny. As soon as I was like, this is what I had to do, with like fireworks go off. So I was like, aha. Working in this company that gave me so much access to all of the science and, you know, all these techniques, right? I was like, okay, cool. So how do I now do that? You know, how do I transition to that, right? Because this company is only focusing on optimizing products to send over to hospitals, right? So I was like, I'm probably not going to get to touch those concepts here, right? They're very focused on one thing. And also industry is most of the time for profit, right? Or at least you got to keep the doors running, right? So if a project is not going some way or is not going to make a certain amount of money, like cut. And that actually happened to one project actually of mine. And that was when I was like, okay, this sucks. I was so passionate about this project and I got it to work. But now you're telling me that it won't take off because it's not making enough profit. Like, that sucks. And I definitely did have, so how I got from that, from the aha moment to industry to then PhD was a combination of personal things that happened and also this idea of wanting to obviously pursue the American dream that was so embedded, you know, in me since I was a kid. So, you know, I think I knew that I wanted to get a PhD or I wanted to be a doctor of some kind, just because that drive was there, you know, the need to fill the American dream, not only just for my parents, but for myself. I think it's something that I value a lot. Like, I do love this country and I do think that, you know, the American dream is alive. And I think that, you know, partially I embody that. And so I felt that in order to continue to make this, you know, dream stay alive, like I felt the need to push myself to those limits to get my PhD, even though I know there's no one in my family that has one. Or I don't have any confidence. Like, I knew I had to get there because of that, of my background and knowing that this is something that I'm here to do. I'm here to reach the highest limit that I can. And I knew that a PhD was one of those ways. So that was like a little bit of vanity. Like, I need to do this, the dream. I need to keep it alive. but besides that, also, at the time, I was serious with in a relationship with someone. And we had lived together for some time during this time that I was working in industry. And she actually moved to San Diego, to pursue her master's. So she was doing her master's at SDSU. I was in Santa Barbara working industry with this idea that, yeah, I want to go back and get my PhD or I want to get my master's. I know that I need to get another degree because a bachelor's, based on our field it's not enough to get you those positions where you have a little bit more control over your career, right? Because as with a bachelor's, there was only a certain amount of jobs that I can get. And those jobs were just not going to meet my career goals. And so I knew that at some point I had to go back to school in order to get that degree. So then even though I'm doing the work now, I know I have the skills, I still need to have that piece of paper in order to really do what I wanted to do. So in order to have that freedom, I know I need to get the work done to get the degree to then do what I wanted to do on my own time with my own brain without having to rely on anyone else. And so, yeah, that was that. And also her being in San Diego, me being in Santa Barbara, I had made, I wouldn't say a promise, but I really wanted to be back with her within a year. So I worked there for a year and a half. And then during that time is when I decided to apply to programs, mostly just all concentrated in San Diego, just so I can be close. So I applied to UCSD. I applied to the joint doctoral program that I'm in now. Sanford Burnham, I believe I also applied to, even Irvine, so just around SoCal area. In order to continue this path of getting a degree needed in order for me to do what I need to do or wanted to do, but also to be closer to her and, you know, that all that kind of stuff.
A two-body problem. Very common.
Very common.
Always is an issue.
Maybe
so, yeah, so,
someone on for
so
that.
Omar was in love and Omar also had this was, you know, trying to pursue higher education and he tried to put both of the things together at once. And then came interviews and then came rejections and then came one hopeful call from the director of the current program that I'm in. He called me and was like, you're a strong applicant and we like you, but there's some members in the committee that aren't 100% sure if you are fully committed to pursuing your PhD. And I think it's based mostly because, I don't know your experience when you guys were applying, but they asked me, after your PhD, like, where do you see yourself going? Mm-hmm. Do you want to go into academia or do you want to go to industry? Like, we know you have some experience with academia. You have some experience with industry now. So where are you going to go? Mm-hmm. And I told them the truth and the most empirical thing you can say, which is, I don't know, because it's so far in the future. There's so much more than just my wanting to go to industry or academia, because, things change over time. Like, that's what life is. So I can't give you a definite, yes, I'm going to academia after my PhD, because I might change my mind like halfway through my PhD, because I had friends who went into their PhD program and were, I'm going to go to academia. And then after having not the best experience in academia are like, nope, I'm going to industry. I don't want to. So I was just taking someone else's experience and wisdom and applying it to my life. But in their eyes, that seemed like I was a little wishy-washy, which I understand. That's fair. I get that. It's an application. It's, all in all, it's like trying to get a job, right? That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. So I understood that. But he gave me the option of, how about we admit you as a master's student? And after your first year, you can then reapply to the PhD program and then go from there. And so I was like, yeah, I want to do that. That makes sense. And also because, again, Omar was in love at the time. And
notice the third person.
That's fine. That's fine. To distance yourself from the situation. No.
It's a coping
mechanism.
So I didn't get into any other PhD programs. After receiving the offer to start as a master's student, I took it. And also, there was one professor that I really, really wanted to work for, and the current program that I'm in, Carrie House. Mm-hmm. Because her lab and where her research was going, it was exactly what I wanted. Like, she was getting into the tumor microenvironment. She was working with resistance. And these are all things that I was working with in the industry, right? But now I want to take that industry experience and actually push the field where, And so I was like, I really want to work with Carrie House. I'll start as a master's student. I've already talked to her. She would, have me on board. So yeah, and that's what I did. I took the gamble of, I'm going to start off as a master's student. And, if it works out that they accept me in a year, great. If not, then I guess I'll just get my master's with an awesome PI that I know has really cool research that I'm passionate about. And I know I was going to learn a lot. So all in all, I knew it was a win. And so I took the gamble of moving to San Diego, start as a master's student with the hopes of, reapplying to the PhD program in a year and potentially get in.
So you were clear on the bachelorette. You were like, oh my God, this is where I'm going. I needed the analogy.
Oh my God.
You're like, this is what I want and I'm going to get it.
And now I'm going to leave the show in four episodes because I found
stop.
I thought you were going to say something else about how for his master's he had to take out private loans.
I was going to ask him about that, actually.
Yeah.
Because that seems like some BS.
Yeah.
Right. No, definitely in retrospect, like out of pocket, it cost me around 10K, like straight up. But that's mostly, I also had some money. Obviously, I was like in the industry, so I was making some cheddar, just a little bit. So it's not like I wasn't completely broke. So, that's another thing about the industry is that the industry, they do pay out a little bit more,
Yeah. So
that was nice. But also, and then when I left, they gave me a pretty hefty bonus. So that also helped out. So I personally took the gamble knowing that, I would probably have to put some money you know, from my bank account into this idea. Mm-hmm. But thankfully for me, and again, I've just been really lucky. You know, I had savings and I have my parents also, support me. They were supporting me during the process. And mm-hmm. I was also, teaching. So I was getting a stipend as well. So it's mm-hmm. not like, so they paid for my tuition through financial aid. So I was able to cover tuition. And in terms of paying for my expenses, I took on a teaching assistant position where I was teaching this, I guess it was molecular biology lab. So just teaching them how to do PCR, gel electrophoresis. So just basic laboratory techniques. And it was a lot of fun. I loved teaching. It was super fun. And I think my students enjoyed having me too.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did you, it's funny that you say PCR and gel electrophoresis, because like that's kind of where you started, right? That the person mm-hmm. working in, I forgot yeah. what the name was, I'm sorry, but they were mentoring you. And now you were able to be the mentor. How did you yeah. like that?
That was cool. And more than that, I'd say also being like a man of color, I feel like it was when other students of color saw me and knew that I was their teacher, I think they felt a little bit, you know, there was a little twinkle in their eyes, you know, like, oh, this person's like me, you know, like, and they're doing yeah. this, you know, like, wow, I yeah. can do it too. And so that was wonderful to have that experience. And yeah, it was definitely interesting to be like, you know, someone, and that's the cool thing about science too and research, where it's a bit like an apprenticeship. You know, someone teaches you how to do things in a certain way, and then you pick up that, right? So, you know, especially with certain techniques or things like that. And then you pass that on to someone else. You pass that knowledge on. And I remember, oh, yes, like this person taught me how to do this. And now I feel like, you know, my students are like, oh, yes, Omar taught me how to pipette, you know? So it's, there's still that personal element as a researcher, you know? So it was definitely really cool.
Reminded me of that time where a mentor at work was like, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. When you have 5 tubes and you have to centrifuge, like balance them, you don't need a balance. First, you balance by 3. Now it's level. Then you balance the 2. And I was like,
it's like giving everyone the tips and tricks. All the
yeah. Shout out to Troy. Love that.
Do you hope to continue mentoring Omar like throughout your career?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's something that I need to do, pay it forward for sure, because definitely did not get here on my own. And something that I missed was in terms of mentorship, the postdoc that I was working as an undergrad was also a man of color. I think his encouragement, if it wasn't for his encouragement, I don't think I would even really thought about a PhD. But one thing, a very important detail that I missed was, I remember specifically one day we were lyophilizing some samples and we were on the elevator in the chemistry building and we were going down to the first floor and he looked at me and he's like, Omar, like you're really good. Like you should really think of getting your PhD. And when he said that, I was like, I have doubts about it, but him, who has already gone through the experience, telling me to go do it was just like, okay, cool. You know, like I may not have confidence in myself, but if you have confidence in me, that means a little bit more than mine at the moment because you have the experience, you know, and you're telling me this. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do it. And so that's what I did. I think that was always in the back of my head where even though I don't have full confidence in myself, this mentor of mine mm-hmm. fully has confidence in me to get my PhD. And so because of him and that idea, yeah. I decided to go ahead and do it, you know, although it took me some time and I worked in the industry to really figure it out, to get that mm-hmm. confidence. And yeah, so mentorship was really important. And yeah, I would never forget that. Like I remember exactly where it happened, what was going on. And yeah, I can still hear his voice. And funny thing, he texted me today. He was like, Omar, how you doing? Like that paper from that work that we were working on, it's actually getting published in Science Advances. so it's still under review and things like that. I shouldn't mm-hmm. say it's published, but it's still under review, but it looks like things are looking good. So yeah, mentorship is very important, because if it wasn't for him and for him giving me that encouragement of like, I think you can get your PhD, I don't think I would have the confidence to do so or even be in the position that I am now. And so moving forward with my PhD, I definitely want to mentor, especially at, I mean, I don't know if there's, in terms of where SDSU, I don't know how many undocumented students in science are there, especially in biology department. Mm-hmm. But if there are some, I would really love to mentor them, because I think that, you know, besides, you know, people of color having more difficulties in the education system, I think it's even more so when it comes to science and research. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being the person that I am and how I look like, I think that it's very important to continue to mentor those that have the same aspirations I did when I was their age, but just didn't have anyone to push them. And so definitely want to do that. And I think after this year, I'll be in a better position with a little bit more time to really cement a mentorship for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I definitely do want a mentor, and I think it's very important. And I wouldn't be where I am now if it wasn't for mentorship. Yeah. So
retweet.
I love that.
Okay, so you are in the middle of a PhD. You're a second year student. Mm-hmm. What kind of happened? Like, you finished your master's. I'm assuming you're in the same lab because I recognize the house name. So, like, what were there any new obstacles getting into the PhD program? How did, like, for us at UCSD, we are on, if you're a citizen, I guess, we are on, like, an NIH training grant. So, like, what kind of funding situation did you have to kind of figure out as an undocumented DACA recipient, mm-hmm. like, now trying to be in a PhD program?
Right. Yeah. So, there's a couple of things. So, just to be clear, so I just transferred from the master's to the PhD. So, I didn't complete my master's.
So
after my first year as a master's student, I reapplied. But the nice thing about it, and also was strategic about it, was because I knew that first year master's students and first year PhD students all take the same classes and are required the same classes. Uh-huh. So I knew that no matter what, even if I did not get into the program after my second try, you know, I can still maybe get my master's, but say if I did get in, then I know that I technically completed my first year as a PhD student, minus the rotations that I would also have to do. And so then after my first year, I applied, I got in, and things became interesting there. So I am like in a hybrid cohort, right? Because I know you guys as my classmates.
Yeah.
And I also have an SDSU cohort. And although in my current program, I'm considered actually a first year, right? Because of just of the term, like when I started, right? Mm-hmm. I'm also already in a lab, right? And I've already completed all of the first year requirements. So I'm in this weird, like, one first year, second year hybrid student. So I say second year, but technically on record in my department, I'm a first year.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a little odd there, but I kind of consider myself more of a second year just because if I had actually gone to the program in the, on the first try, mm-hmm. like I should have, you know, I had to have all those requirements. In terms of funding, my lab is funded. There's some NIH grant funding and some startup grants from the SDSU system. So that's how I'm covered. So yeah, my current PI has been very generous and has given me the opportunity to essentially be funded through her grants without having to worry about finding my own funding or taking the option of teaching again. So that's the other thing. It's if I was not bought out, right, or if my professor did not pay for the other half of the cost of living or for the program, then what I would have to be required is to teach in order to continue getting a stipend and continue doing my research. And talking about funding as a DACA recipient, again, I don't qualify for federal loans or grants. So it's a little dicey there. So even though it is required in my program to submit an F-31 NIH grant, so like, it's just a little, you know, different for me just because I want to write that grant because it's, you know, it's very, I think, important in my training as a PhD student, being able to submit a grant of that size and, more importantly, being able to, you know, lock down my own funding. I think it's a very important part as a graduate student to get that training. And so that's where it gets a little odd. There's definitely some fellowships and there's definitely resources for undocumented or DACA recipient students pursuing higher education. And I do have a link to all of that. And so I am actively applying to those fellowships and grants that I see. But anything federal, so anything NIH level type of stuff, I do not qualify for. I can technically apply to it, but I cannot receive the funding. So that's where it gets a little dicey, where it's like, okay, like I can submit probably, but I probably can't receive the fund because I'm not a citizen. So what do I do at that point? And that's still something that, yeah, it just gets a little weird there. Do I go ahead and then just give the funding to my PI? To, you know, like what happens there?
Yeah.
Besides that, also another thing that I've been doing in terms of, you know, securing funding or things like that as a PhD student and as a DACA recipient is my PI also, of course, you know, she's writing so many different grants all over the place and there's always smaller grants, right? And so at SDSU, there's the microscopy core, and they submitted a grant to get NIH funding to buy a cryo-EM electron microscope. And my PI gave me the... Yeah, they're really expensive. Very expensive. And my PI always offers me opportunities to continue grant writing or proposing projects. So she offered me the opportunity to go ahead and see if I can use this really expensive piece of, you know, microscopy technique to maybe apply to my project or a project I have in mind. And so that's what I did. I took that challenge and I proposed this project that will go in this big grant with a bunch of other projects from other faculty in the in the department who also wish to use this instrument for their own research. And so that's another thing I can do. I can kind of be like a ghostwriter, I guess, you know, or quote unquote, I suppose more the technical term would be, the co-writer of a grant or, you know, so that's what it would be. That's kind of the situation where I am now, where it's, I kind of have to co-write, right? Because of the technicality that I cannot, receive the aid if it's federal because I'm not a citizen. But there's ways. And again, I mean, I just got really lucky with the fact that my professor also since the beginning knew about my situation. So if you are a DACA recipient or undocumented student who is pursuing a PhD, make sure that whichever labs you're deciding to rotate in or your final choice, make sure that that professor really understands like your case, that they know that you are undocumented and that they understand what that means for you and what that means for your PhD career. And my PI has just been very, very generous and very understands where I am and also still sees my potential and knows that, you know, I'm a good scientist. And so that's my word of advice is there's definitely funds out there and there is ways to get around it. But ultimately, make sure that the PI that you work really understands your financial situation because you can't click that box that says you're a citizen. That's literally it. Like, as sad as that is, that's literally it. I just can't click that little box. That's all. But that's not going to stop me from doing what I want to do. You know, there's always a lot of other ways to get around it. And I've proven that so far. I've mm-hmm. you know, I'm still here with you guys, and you know, I'm still trying to do my science, and yeah,
I love that for you. I am very excited to see where this journey as a first year takes you.
Okay. So Omar, you just shared a lot about what you're passionate about, what you do for research and your journey, but who are you outside of the lab? What is it that you like to do? How do you spend your time?
Well, with the quarantine, I really took on gardening. And so I've become a full-time scientist and half-time farmer. So I have so much growing in my yard. And this is a brainchild of me and one of my housemates. And I just love gardening. We have arugula, spinach, Swiss chard, broccoli, sweet potatoes, pink oyster mushrooms, figs, basil, cilantro, parsley, onions, strawberries. And every single day for lunch, I go into my yard. I pick some arugula, some spinach, some Swiss chard. I cut it up, make a beautiful, beautiful salad. And it's such a spiritual experience, just growing your own food. And it makes me so happy. Like, as a biologist, it's just seeing photosynthesis happen right in front of your eyes. It's just incredible. That's one of my biggest passions, is just, I love that. Besides that, I mean, I enjoy exercising, and it's something that I do regularly, as well as meditation. I'm a big meditator. It's definitely something that I recommend all graduate students to do, or anyone who is in a high stress environment, a high anxiety environment. Meditation is the key to a good life. And that's what I like to do. And that's what I'm passionate about, besides science, is growing
that.
A bunch of food and having spiritual moments of me eating the nutrients of these plants that I raised.
Let's take a little break to hear from our sponsors, and then we will get a little bit of some closing advice and some thoughts from you.
Sanit Factory is a Black-owned skin and body care line.
Created by a biochemistry college graduate who loves taking an extra step into the world of luxury self-care at home.
They sell whipped body scrubs that are natural and vegan friendly while also providing your skin with a glow.
So if you're coming home from a long day of meetings or from being stuck in the lab, when you add Sanit Factory products to your wind down routine, you'll know your skin is being spoiled with the richest ingredients. You can follow them on Instagram and Facebook at Sainted Factory and purchase at saintedfactory.com.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Before we say goodbye to Omar, I would love to hear any final advice. I know that you just gave some, but do you have any final words for people listening?
Yeah, I think based on my experience and I guess my headspace, if you're undocumented and you want to pursue higher education, just do it. You know, if you have a passion for it, just do it. You'll definitely find a way to get where you want to get to. It's just about being creative and being smart and strategic, because as undocumented, there's extra hoops we have to jump through. You know, we all jump through hoops in order to get where we are now, but as someone who's undocumented, you have to jump through one extra hoop. But there's, you know, you got to just build a stamina to be able to jump over that hoop and get to where you want to be. Secondly, definitely find good mentors find good mentors that would support you and understand your situation, as well as if you're applying to PhD programs as someone who's a DACA recipient or undocumented, make sure that, as I mentioned before, make sure that the professor really understands who you are, or quote unquote, make sure they know that, you know, make sure they're woke, you know, as they say, make sure they understand your situation, because that makes it, that either makes it or breaks it. And in my case, I've just been very lucky to have a PI and mentor who supports me and understands where I'm coming from. And even though there's extra obstacles, she still sees my, you know, potential and my passion for science. And so she facilitates that. And I couldn't have a better setup. And so my advice is find those opportunities. In order to find those opportunities, you got to take the time to get there. I'd say that's the advice. Just do what you want to do. And I have doubts all the time. I definitely have at least a doubt about what I'm doing at least once a week. And I think that's healthy because then that really makes you understand that, okay, like what you're doing is, you know, there's a give and take. So it's natural to have those self-doubting thoughts, but it's about choosing not to listen to them, you know?
Ooh.
Yeah. Yes. You have a choice. I have a choice. Like, you cannot control those thoughts because thoughts are like sounds, right? And I can't control what sounds come through my ear. I can only choose what sounds I get to listen to or I pay attention to. So ultimately, all I really have is my attention. And so anytime I have negative thoughts about myself or my situation, especially someone who's undocumented, I just choose not to listen to them because that is something that I can do. Because I know better. I can train myself and my mind to, instead of anytime I have a negative doubt about my situation, there's at least five positive things that are happening. And I'd say that is a life philosophy of mine is, you have the choice to pay attention to thoughts that are convenient and efficient to you. And that's something that I recommend.
Great. Thank you. So to round out the show, let's do some observations, run some stats in our data, which will be getting better as the quarter progresses. Thanks to a certain biostats class. Asama, what is the question this week?
All right, so the question is very on brand. It is, who here supports undocumented students pursuing their PhD if they so desire?
Yes, 100%.
Hell yeah.
Definitely me. Omar?
He said head nod.
All right, so I think 100% of the PhD students in our study do believe in undocumented students, and we know that they could do anything they put their mind to.
Yeah, what if I was like, no?
Oh my God. We just had a discussion about thoughts and being purposeful.
Honestly, no.
No.
The world is your oyster, no matter where you are.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. If there's anything you would like to share with us, just feel free to send us an email or find us on socials.
Yeah, and you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at triplicatespod, and you can email us at triplicatespod@gmail.com. And if you like us and you want to support us, you can find us on patreon.com/triplicatespod. And with that,
obrigada y ciao.
Gracias y adiós.
Kapunka. Bye.
Bye, everyone.